Harold Evans, excuse me, Harold Evans quotes from Charles Dickens to describe the current state of the English language. Fog everywhere. From Facebook posts to news reports, software agreements to advertising copy, political speeches to insurance forms, unintelligible writing is everywhere. Harold Evans is a legendary editor and writer who was knighted for his service to journalism. His new book, Do I Make Myself Clear? Why Writing Well Matters, is both a guide and a manifesto. It's published by Little Brown. I'm very happy that it brings Sir Harold Evans back to our show. Welcome back.
I'm honored to be back.
And I hope that you can tell from that intro, where I use the word everywhere twice, that I don't suffer from monologophobia. Is that a word you invented?
No, I wished I had. The word was invented by Theodore Bernstein of the New York Times. And the definition of it is a monologophobe who practices monologophobia. It would be rather caught naked outside Saks Fifth Avenue than use the same word twice in one paragraph. And what he was getting at was, I have examples throughout the book that will refer to, say, a Ted Cruz, a candidate you may remember in the distant past of the 2016 election, and next time will be called a businessman or a Christian or something, but he won't retain his identity. So at the end of a bout of monologophobia, which is very catching, you're wondering, who the hell is this? Because it's changed. Mm-hmm. I have another example of a writer or a reporter, or a speechmaker actually, frightened to use the word Crimea twice in the same sentence, so it becomes the Black Sea Peninsula. Wait a minute, are we still on the same page?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with using it as long as it doesn't sound like you're just leaning on it.
Exactly, and the invention of alternatives is actually worse than repetition of the name.
It often sounds
tortured.
Because
the alternative that throws you. And often one is puzzled about how to... people are frightened of boring the reader. You won't bore the reader. It's much better to bore him than to mystify him.
With all the problems we have today, how much concern should we have about whether something is written well or not?
Oh, my heavens.
Getting
fantastic.
Right to it, Harry.
It's much writing well is much more than a linguistic or grammatical element in language. To me, it's a moral issue when language is used to deceive, as it has been and is being, for instance, in the fulfillment of promises of health policies, insurance policies. And when the language is not merely obscure but deceptive, as it is in many of these policies, and many tragedies occur. One of the great tragedies of our time, when 124 people were killed in General Motors cars, was because the first intimation of the problem with the airbags was to say it was a question of consumer convenience and comfort. It wasn't. It was a question of safety. And safety was a word that was verboten.
Don't you also argue that bad writing was in part responsible for the Great Recession of 2008? Now, was that bad writing intentional, intended to mislead, or is it just that some things aren't written well?
Everybody was in the act. The millions of people who signed mortgages, they hadn't understood and probably didn't get to the end of the contract for fear of being impaled on a lion, as it were, made people didn't finish. When they tried to finish, the language was so confusing. And as we know from The Big Short, an excellent movie, by the way, and an excellent book, people were generally trying to deceive people to sign more stuff and more stuff and more stuff. And the masters of the universe didn't understand what they were doing either.
But we also tend to trust the people who put those things in front of us. When your cell phone suddenly has this thing that goes on and on and on and on and on and on with a little button that says agree at the end, you don't read all of that six-point type.
Quite right. That is one of my nightmares, because most of us don't get to the end of those clauses and contracts. And Silicon Valley has a lot to answer for. Even the great Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, when he does his annual report, he's talking in a language he's almost alien. He doesn't talk about people on Facebook. He talks about such users. Mm-hmm. When they discovered that such users, i.e. you and me, were in a different location, then we get a long, convoluted sentence about it. Instead of the same when he says that we've had a lot of complaints, instead of saying, this is bad for us, which is just enough, it goes on, this considering the effect on our revenues and our reputation, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So excess wordage is often one of the reasons I'm pressing.
Is he doing that on purpose, you think, to
obscure? No, somebody's probably written it for him. I mean, Leonard, it's
a lawyer may have written it for him.
Oh, somebody written it for him. The point is, what I'm trying to get is that it's hard to be concise when you're trying to wrap things up, and business is the worst offender. There's a friend of mine who's done very well. He was asked to go to a liquidation event. What was a liquidation event? It was the business term for the selling his company. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you say, come and discuss the sale of your company, instead of come to our liquidation event? I mean, it's full, and business is absolutely terrible. Take any annual report, and almost anybody can see that it's convoluted and obscure when it should be. The best person, of course, is Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett says we had a very bad year. This is why we had a bad year. You don't get that. You get adverse consequences will follow from this. So people get very irritated and suspicious of business contracts and business language, partly for the good reason that they're often obscuring things that should be clear, and partly because it's so confusing.
My guest is Harold Evans, whose latest book is Do I Make Myself Clear? Why Writing Well Matters. It's published by Little Brown. This is WMIC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You seem to be suggesting that the best writing is the writing that sounds most like speech.
That's an interesting point. I'm talking about...
Because Warren Buffett is writing the way that he would talk.
Yes, exactly. I'm not suggesting that a novelist should be as concise and as, in fact,
you allow metaphors and similes?
Pardon?
You allow for metaphors and similes?
Yeah, of course, and similes, metaphors and similes.
Although you don't like adjectives and adverbs.
Yeah, well, anything that makes the meaning clear and improves understanding. Now, George Orwell, of course, did that. If you read Orwell on the English language, he's asking you to be clear. There's a wonderful new book out about Churchill and Orwell.
We had Thomas Ricks on our show today.
Yes, exactly. So that what I'm arguing about and what I'm trying to get over is the fact that people get frightened of grammar. So they start introducing clauses and things. James Thurber went mad when he was trapped inside a which clause. Don't worry about the which clause, isn't that and which and whom. And no linguist will really quarrel with me for saying this, but it's much better to try and make your words clear and follow your instincts about what is clear and don't worry too much about that and which.
Now, can good writing be taught?
Yes. There's a wonderful example. There's a book out in Britain by somebody who's analysed Our God, Shakespeare. And he goes through Shakespeare from the very early plays and language, and it's very often based on Plutarch and the lives of Plutarch. And so he finds passages which are basically lifted. And then he shows how, in this marvellous book on the eloquence of Shakespeare, he shows how all the devices, all the genius of rhetoric is employed by the bad she sat in was of burnished gold, alliteration, B. But it's more than that, because, of course, Shakespeare is not just a wordsmith, he's a moralist. And so what makes Shakespeare so memorable is not only the quality of the language, it's also the perception of moral character.
But he also had iambic pentameter. Mm-hmm. He had iambic pentameter to help him along.
Yeah, well,
along.
You see, there you could go. You see, iambic pentameter. Don't ask me to define that mm-hmm. now. I just know when I hear a friend. By the way, one of my exciting experiences in life was to be with Marlon Brando because I published his book. And friends, Roman countrymen, lend me your ears. Why did Marlon, to me, emphasize the word lend? Because he's in a crowd of murderers who would kill him just mm-hmm. like that as they killed Caesar. But he's only there asking you to lend me your ears. Because I'm going to go and I'm going to make love to Cleopatra.
You were a junior reporter on a weekly newspaper at 16. What was your job and do you think that you wrote well at that point?
My job then, it was actually one of the reasons I've written this book. My job was, I did phonetic shorthand. I was 120 words a minute shorthand, 80 words a minute typing. I had gone through business college. I'd left school at 15. So my job was to take down in shorthand every single word said in the law court, every single word said in the council meeting, and then transcribe them for the big boys back at the office, the reporters. And I got immense frustration that the verbosity so was planted in my soul was a hatred of verbosity and circumlocution and a desire for conciseness. So I went through all the speeches and wrote them up as concisely as I could. And the difference was not only a saving in my temper, but also a huge saving in the time and effort of the reader.
Aren't newspaper journalists kind of taught to think that way because there are often space concerns?
Well, there are space concerns, of course, yes. When I was talking about working on a weekly newspaper and then an evening newspaper, we were dealing with hot metal type. And I constantly was told, it's not rubber, you know. You have to fit this particular space. And so I learned early on to fit the space. Now, on the web, you don't have to fit the space. You can go on and on and on and on and on and on. And you don't have to pick up the actual
structure.
Unless
you're tweeting, of course.
Well, tweeting is 147 characters. You know what tweeting is good for? Assertion. It's not any good for argument, not any good for reasoned argument. So it's all right for Mr. Trump to tweet, but it's a mere assertion of one statement against another. It's not advancing human knowledge. In fact, of course, as we know, and I wonder if I might, I would love to read something written by an Englishman about Mr. Trump. Is that possible?
Of course. We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll have you read that.
Okay.
But when you were at the Manchester Evening News, didn't you write a daily pronouncement on whatever the editor thought was the misuse of the moment?
Yes. The big Tom Henry, who was the editor of the Manchester Evening News, had built his newspaper up to be a huge success by the directness and terseness. So I was just fresh from university. So I was writing editorials, and I would spend 15, 20 minutes on the first paragraph. I thought, that's rather good. I've used this metaphor. I've done this simile. And I went up. When the proof came down from Big Tom, the entire first paragraph had gone. He said, get to the point. Get to the point. I was mortified. But every time when I was writing something that was kind of long-winded, I was hearing his voice in my ear, get to the point, get to the point. Get like a railway train, get to the point, get to the point, get to the point.
When I have to edit other people's writing, I think the same thing. Often cut out an awful lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Just get to the point. But you also came to teach in Southeast Asia. Do you learn a lot about using the language well when you're teaching somebody who speaks a foreign language?
Well, it sounds as though I invented this, but it's true. I was standing in a garden in Delhi with Pandit Nehru. And I've been brought over from England to see if the Indian newspapers, which had been taught by imperialistic Britons on subjects of complete irrelevance to the Indian villager, could be made to speak more directly to the concerns that matter to the Indian people or the Filipino people or the South Koreans and the Japanese, actually. All these places I went through couldn't understand the language. But I got the translations, and I said, this can be more concise. This is our answer. And so I learned a lot. And, you know, I really love being with the Indians who have a passion for language, which often comes out as kind of extra eloquence. But I did learn a lot there from in that process.
And you say you also learned a lot from learning how to ski. How does skiing connect it to language?
I was very resentful when I reached the age of 42. And my late wife and I went up skiing, and I couldn't do it. And this seemed to me a terrible thing because I was an athlete. I was captain of athletics at college, and here I couldn't do this elementary thing. Elementary. So I bought a very good book on skiing, and it told me what to do with my right elbow, my knee, my shoulder, my midriff, my back end, when I was paralyzed with fear at the top of a mountain. I couldn't remember what I was supposed to do with the left ear, never mind the right ear and the knee. So I thought, well, there must be a simpler way of putting this. And so I took a group of Sunday Times writers and graphic artists and photographers, and we all went through the courses with a Scottish disciplinarian, and at the end of the book, we only wrote at what we could understand and what we could say to somebody. Now, make sure at this point you push forward with both knees. Okay, that's enough for the moment. Thank you.
And the book was called We Learned to Ski.
And it was a huge success. It was actually sold 800,000 copies, I was told.
Well, the book we are talking about from Harold Evans is Do I Make Myself Clear? Why Writing Well Matters. It's published by Little Brown. And we will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Harold Evans, whose latest book is Do I Make Myself Clear? Why Writing Well Matters. It's published by Little Brown. You were the editor of the Sunday Times in London. For people in this country who have no idea about the significance of that, at least at that time, the Sunday Times was perhaps the most respected paper, at least weekend paper, in England?
Oh, certainly. Well, it had a circulation of 1.5 million. It was staffed, with one exception, with very brilliant people.
And who was the exception?
I was the exception. So I leaned on them a lot to write clearly. But the most important thing we did, which I was certainly with them 100%, was to investigate. For instance, there's a film on Netflix at the moment called Attacking the Devil. And that's about how we came to the rescue of thalidomide children without a leg or an arm or whatever it may be. And it took us 8 years to solve. That was the Sunday Times at its best. And we had the freedom to do that because, one, we were profitable and successful. But, two, we had an ownership that encouraged truth.
Should I assume that anyone who was hired by the Times didn't require much editing?
No. All of us, one of the universal truths, and I'm not quoting Jane Austen now, is that all writers need editing. Mm-hmm. And all the best writers can admit that. I know the argument about Hemingway is how many times he wrote the last page of Farewell to Arms. So we all need editing. And when I wrote an editorial at the Sunday Times, I'd give it to one of my colleagues. And the colleague would expect me to comment in his editorial.
Well, you mentioned Hemingway. You also were at Random House for 7 years, where you were the editor-in-chief. But what happens when you have a writer like Norman Mailer or E.L. Doctorow? Can you tell them that they've got to do some serious editing?
Well, yes. I mean, they were so brilliant. I mean, I was remarking once to Doctorow, Jason Epstein was his line editor. More than that, Jason Epstein was a genius in publishing. And the point is, I said to Ed, I wonder where this story's going at the water. And he said, you know. Edgar Doctorow. And a genius, brilliant man. It was so. I wish he was with us today. It was so out of suit at these Trumpian times of ours. So he said, well, it's like driving a car. The headlights, you can do the whole journey if you just follow the headlights and don't try and see where you're going beyond that, following that instruction. No, Norman Mailer was marvellous. Of course, you can't possibly expect to win an argument with Norman Mailer, because he had such knowledge, such gusto, and such ferocity. So around the edges, I was president and publisher, not editor-in-chief, and got off, succeeded that title, and Jason was really the editor-in-chief. I was president and publisher. I had the responsibility of saying, we're going to back this book by this obscure community organizer called, what's his name again?
Barack Obama.
Okay, well, we'll back it, yeah, because it reads very well, but nobody knows him, and it became, of course, one of the most important books ever published, for which the credit goes to Peter Osnos and the people working with him.
Now, you said that your favorite job was line editing. When you're the president of a publishing company, do you still do some line editing?
Do it. I'm a repeat offender. I mean, wherever you go, if you were giving me a bus ticket, I'm going to edit the small print. I cannot stop. It's a compulsion. Help, help. I mean, it's like that famous cartoon of Northcliffe. When I took over the Times, I took over the London Daily Times, I framed a cartoon of Northcliffe message in which one of the editor of the Times is being made to say, hold me fast, I feel the demons of sensation arriving within me. That's how I was. I had to be held down fast.
Well, the Daily Times had a reputation for not ever doing a recap on a story. You had to be totally up on the news. Every day, it just assumed that you knew everything about what was going on up to that point. No other newspaper would dare to do that.
No, it was a first-class paper, always was. I'd had some bad times during the interwar years. It was supporting Hitler and would not allow anything to be published which would upset Herr Hitler.
Wow.
But after it was bought by Roy Thomson and William Rees-Mogg was the editor, it had a good period. And I was very honored to be editor of the Daily Times.
Why do you prefer the English word full stop to the American period?
Well, let's just ask our audience here. If you hear the word period, what do you think of? Do you think of the end of a sentence or do you think of menstruation? What do you think of? It's a completely misleading expression.
When I was a proofreader, we used to say point at the end of the sentence.
Well, point I would accept. Point's okay. And I was being a proofreader too, so I've seen the use of the word point. But I like full stop because it says it's much like a loud voice and you stop, you've gone far enough.
You tell an amazing story about the University of Nebraska in 1882. Who was Lucius Adelmo Sherman?
He was a brilliant young man, lost his wife soon after he married her, and he devoted his life to the study of language and in particular to the length of sentences, what he called predication, and traced how the number of words had declined in literature to be shorter sentences, and why it was that increased comprehension. So you see him starting with 50-word sentences and then gradually coming to the modern period when a 14-word sentence, and of course now it's tolerable to have two or three-word sentence. Women and children first. Not anything more convoluted than that.
But Conrad could write a sentence that went on for two pages and you understood every word. Oh. Faulkner did something similar.
Oh, yes.
But Hemingway changed it all?
Hemingway's about writing said, there's nothing to it. All you do is sit down at a typewriter and bleed. Well, that's true, but of course you get a genius like Faulkner. I'm not arguing for curtailing sentences when there's something being said with clarity and with wit and with good imagery. I'm not arguing against that. I'm talking about most communication when you're trying to get over something simply and not confusing it too much in a way. He's a great writer. When I do my pencil editing, for instance, telling the story in the book of Bernard Levin, who is a wonderful writer, and he gave me a sentence of 167 words. All I wanted was one tiny point. And we argued and argued. I said, you know, you're like going through a Venetian palace, and by the time you get to the masterpiece at the end, your feet are tired and you've got to sit down. That's the point you've reached with this sentence.
How important are the rules of grammar or proper syntax to the goal of clear writing? Because you write that you thought Donald Trump was an effective communicator during the presidential campaign, and he does not always follow the rules of grammar.
No, no.
Or spelling, for that matter.
What frightened me was actually the clarity of his language for a bad purpose, in my view, a bad purpose. We've got to build a wall. We've got to build a wall. A wall to work. Wall to work. We've got to build a wall. Wall to work. And USA Today. USA. And so that was going on. At the same time, that simple language, when used to explain something else, like, for instance, if you take his explanation of climate change, it's almost impossible to understand. This is what he says about climate change. I believe there's weather. I believe there's change. And I believe it goes up. And it goes down, and it goes up again, and it changes depending on years and centuries. But I'm not a believer, and we have much bigger problems. Thanks for a non-contribution to the advancement of science. And so the problem with Donald Trump, of course, is everybody knows that he's a serial liar. But I want to remind you, I'd just like to give you an insight into how this is dangerous. And this is a quotation from a writer. He has never yet considered whether any proposition were true or false, but whether it were convenient for the present minute or company to affirm or deny it. Right? You with me? So then if you think to refine upon him by interpreting everything he says as we do dreams, by the contrary of what he's saying, you are still to seek and find yourself equally deceived, whether you believe or not. The only remedy is to suppose that you have heard some inarticulate sounds without any meaning at all. Now, the man who wrote that was Jonathan Swift, Gulliver's Travels. So
pretty good
there
writer.
You have it in a different style of language. The same point, that you're actually facing something which is basically incomprehensible.
You are critical of the use of the passive tense.
Yes.
Tell us why you also don't like adjectives or adverbs, or I guess the what you also call the zombification of nouns.
Zombification, yes. Get me understand this right. Let's just define a zombie first. Helen Sawyer, a professor in New Zealand, defines zombie as when a noun swallows a verb. So instead of, I authorize Leonard Lapote to do so-and-so, the authorization for Mr. Lapote to speak was signed by, you add words, same as you do with the passive voice. When you use the passive voice, here's a sentence in the passive voice. The moon was landed on by Neil Armstrong. Okay, what's the active voice? Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. Mm-hmm. So the passive voice always breathes extra syllables, words, always. And also, it's a fantastically effective way of evading responsibility. So I analysed the story of the underpant bomber, and the refrain there is, steps were taken. What do you mean, steps? Who did what? What was the effect? Mistakes were made. Coffee was served. or the notice on the board when I was in a business community. The directors have decided they will meet the... Anyway, the point is I don't want to go on. There are so many examples.
Are split infinitives and ending a sentence with a preposition still considered bad form?
Well, I tell you what, I do prefer honesty to pay instead of honesty paying off. I don't like adding the... I mean, my example, of course, is the fact that many of these propositions get it added on by people who are not... English is not their first call. I mean, Mark Twain has this wonderful sentence about a German is a man who dives into the Atlantic and emerges at the other side with the verb in his mouth. Okay, I change that because I say a German is a man who dives into the Atlantic and at the other side with the verb in his mouth emerges with the German preference for ending at the end.
They like the end of sentence.
I love these permutations of English. And all of us, I'm not a linguist. I mean, my rudimentary French would get you arrested in any port. But nonetheless, I find, you know, Madame Bovary, for instance, I love the story of Madame Bovary.
You have to tell it quickly because we're out of time.
Okay, well, he used to read his stuff to the flower, so that was a very effective way of deciding whether you'd written anything intelligible or not.
Am I being too picky when I object to media being used as a singular or people mixing up less and few?
I wouldn't be too picky. I mean, I always prefer to say fewer and so on, but I get rebuked by some modernists, so I go cautiously around strict rules like that, which don't impede my real meaning.
Harold Evans, his latest book is Do I Make Myself Clear? Why Writing Well Matters. It is published by Little Brown. And as always, it's been a great pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you very much. Thank you.